Today at Reader's Corner, Bryce Andrews, author of the new book, Holding Fire, A Reckoning with the American West. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. When our guest today inherited his grandfather's revolver, he began to question its place in his family's life. In his latest book, Holding Fire, Bryce Andrews chronicles his journey to forge a new path for himself and to reshape one handgun into a tool for good work. As waves of gun violence swept the country and wildfires burned across his beloved valley, he began questioning ranchers, his native neighbors, his family, and a blacksmith who taught him to shape steel in search of a new way to live with the land and with one another. Bryce Andrews is the author of Down from the Mountain, which won the Banff Mountain Book Competition, and Bad Luck Way, which garnered the High Plains Book Award for both nonfiction and debut novel. I interviewed Bryce for both of those books, and if you would like to listen to them, search for the podcast on the Reader's Corner app at Boise State Public Radio website. Bryce Andrews, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me, Bob. It's wonderful to be back.
Well, Bryce, I can't come close to using the kind of beautiful language your reviewers used with this book, an exquisite meditation of the West, a song to the West, gorgeously writing of what lies underneath the idealized glamour of the American West. I'm going to tell you right now that many, many years ago, I had the privilege of sitting down in the living room of Wendell Berry, an environmental activist, a farmer, a guy who has written as you write about the land, about small-scale agriculture. And in case our listeners wonder who they're listening to today, I have every reason to believe that Wendell Berry, who is now 90, has a successor in his work, and it's Bryce Andrews. You've done a marvelous job here, and I want to thank you for that and get right into my first question, which is, locate us geographically. Where you live and work in Montana with mountains as the backdrop.
Absolutely. I'll tell you that. But first, I do want to say, because of those kind words about Wendell Berry, that he's a very important writer for me. I farm and ranch as well as write. You know, you can't do that without having these moments, sort of crises of agricultural faith is maybe one way to put it.
Right.
Where we think, is this worth it? And sometimes when I'm having those moments, you know, on our farm, I do think about Wendell Berry and you know, his dedication both to deep thinking and to the practical work of agriculture. And it's always a source of hope for me. But to your question, I'm calling you, I'm talking to you from our farm, which is just north of Missoula on the Flathead Reservation here in western Montana. Much of my life since I moved out from Washington, where I was raised, has taken place in valleys that bear some resemblance to this one, where you see people running cattle and raising crops at the base of extremely wild, ecologically intact mountain ranges. So I've lived and worked for most of my adult life in these places where the domesticated world and the wild one rub shoulders. Honestly, that's the source for a lot of the thinking that I'm happiest with and the work that I'm happiest with, both agricultural and literary.
And you came to Montana as a Seattle suburban kid, and thanks to a family that took you in, you might say, that's where it all started, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I was really fortunate. So I grew up in the middle of Seattle. My dad worked at the University of Washington, and we lived pretty near the campus. But I was so lucky to find my way to the Zents Ranch, which is a multi-generational ranch outside of Billings. And my Pat and Susie Zents are my atheist godparents, is how they probably like described. You know, wonderful people, extremely hardworking. Similarly to Wendell Berry, you know, Pat in particular is one of those people who blends agriculture and art, because the Zents had a working ranch for the entirety of my childhood, growing up, teenage years. They were running cattle commercially, but Pat is also a really interesting visual artist. It makes work that translates, you know, wind and topography into sound and movement. So he made these machines that would essentially observe and report on the landscape and the weather. Now, this is grossly oversimplifying it, but mm-hmm. it's beautiful work. And what it meant to me was that agriculture, when it's viewed in that context, can be a way of looking at land closely. And that was a really important part of my development, because I started to see the work of ranching as a way of being close to and observing intact ecological systems. And that's been an enduring curiosity of mine ever since.
So let's establish your bona fides as a real Westerner, Bryce. You call yourself a hunter after you shot an elk, cow, and bull. And then every year thereafter, you say you have taken a cow or a bull whenever you want, which puts you right there in the category of a real Westerner, doesn't it?
Oh, sure. Well, I'll first say that you should never put in print something like, I have taken an elk every time I wanted one, because in the 3 years since I put those lines on paper, I've not gotten an elk. So it's pretty funny.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
I managed to minorly curse myself. At the heart of this book, Holding Fire, it's a complex relationship with wilderness, but also violence. I moved, I was raised in Seattle, as I said, by a conscientious objector. So my father refused to fight in Vietnam. Both my mother and father are people who didn't own guns, weren't interested in hunting, that kind of stuff. But when I ended up working on these ranches, and living in these places where you did have, grizzly bears on the landscape, you did have cattle that needed to be put down, you did have a vibrant culture of people hunting and eating from the wilderness, that was really compelling for me. And I began to hunt seriously for deer and elk in the fall. And that was the majority of what I ate for protein. This book really tracks the evolution of a relationship, because when I first came out here and was exposed to that, I loved how close hunting brought me to the land. And what I mean by that is that when you go out hunting deer and elk in the fall, you go to places that you otherwise would have no reason to visit. You end up in these little untracked drainages at times of day and times of year that only hunting would cause you to go there. And I loved that. And I loved participating in the way that nature works, right? By eating from the place where I lived. I loved that for a long time. But as I did it more and more, I began to have these darker and more complicated feelings about the weapons we use, the things we carry, and how that ties us to complicated, difficult histories in the West. I'd be happy to go into that more. But regarding hunting, I'd just say this is, I never liked killing things. And as a rancher, I've ranched for almost 20 years now. And as a rancher, I never have liked killing, and killing is part of ranching. Whether it's taking animals to slaughter or putting down, a cow with a broken leg that you can't cure, that's always been a difficult thing and something that I've never been able to just sit easily with. Part of why I wrote this book is wanting to understand what's at the bottom of that feeling and really understand it and make peace with it.
And at one point, you actually came across a significant violation of American Western values, I guess I could say, the slaughter of a mule deer herd. And I think your language in describing what that did to you, to make a life in ranching means watching people vent their rage on animals, something deep began to rankle once I began to see out of the eyes of animals. I thought that one in particular really hit the nail on the head as I read your book.
I wonder why it is that we don't more often see out of the eyes of animals these days, because it's profoundly interesting. And, as somebody who interacts with, I see deer every day of my life on this farm. And so that proximity, that intimate sharing of a landscape, causes you to begin to think about what their lives are like. And I think maybe that's part of the issue here, is that so often now we create this artificial distance from the natural world. And I think it erodes our capacity Or at least it makes it harder for us to develop sympathy or empathy as regards the lives of animals. But, you know, one thing about ranching and farming where I do is you think a lot about animals. You don't have to be a smart person or a deep thinking one for the facts of the lives of animals to intrude upon your mind. It's just the materials that your world is made out of, you know?
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Bryce Andrews, author of the new book, Holding Fire, A Reckoning with the American West. And you're searching in this book, as you did in real life, obviously, for some kind of ritual to transform your grandfather's gun that you inherited into something more akin to today's challenges, something more of a solution. So you visited with Germaine White, and I want you to tell us about her. She's valuable to your story in two ways. First of all, she gives you some sage advice on what your next step ought to be before you do anything. But then, even more importantly, she tells you about the difference between our modern day focus on sustainability and the tribal focus on reciprocity.
So Germaine White is a friend of mine. For a long time, she was the director of education and outreach for the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes, of which she's a member. And, you know, she's been in my life for a long time, you know, as a person who has always been extremely kind to me and showed me, she always just manifested a lot of care for me. And so she's somebody who I would go to talk about important things. And this business with my grandfather's gun, which you mentioned, was an important thing. So I inherited this revolver. My grandfather, you know, was in the process of passing away, and the gun came through my father, who, as a person of peace, a nonviolent person, wanted nothing to do with it. So this Smith & Wesson 357, beautiful, beautiful gun, ended up in my care, and I used it for years as a ranch manager. I carried it when I was afraid of bears. I used it to, you know, euthanize cows when I had to. It just was part of my life. And that gun in particular was the one that started to give me these very complicated, somewhat dark feelings that had to do with legacies of violence and cultures of violence and objects of violence in the American West. Carrying that gun, I began to have this feeling that our tools, the tools we carry, that they work upon us, that they affect us, because every tool offers you a set of possibilities. A rancher friend of mine once said this thing that stuck with me, which is, he said, you know, a guy buys a backhoe and suddenly everything starts looking like it needs to be a hole. I remember thinking that. Yeah. Yeah, I know. It just, you know, he said that, it stuck with me. And I thought, well, in many ways, that's, you know, he said that better than I could ever hope to. But that gun started to have an effect on me, right? I carried that gun all the time. I kept it really close. And I began to have these really difficult thoughts that had to do both with, you know, the gun's relation, its destructive potential, the ease with which it could be turned on myself or other things in the world. And I started to have this strong feeling like I needed to unmake that gun. But I wanted to do that in a way that respected both the object and my grandfather, because the object was beautiful and I love my grandfather. And I can love him and appreciate that object even if I want to diverge from aspects of the history that it represents and that he was carrying forward. That's what caused me to find my way to Germaine. You know, I had been thinking about it. I was thinking, what am I going to do with this thing? Am I going to take it out in the ocean and drop this gun into the sea? Am I going to walk it to the top of a mountain and throw it down a glacier? What am I going to do with this? But all of those things felt, to some extent, like vandalism and like destroying a gift. When I talked to Germaine, we talked about many things, but among them, I think the most relevant would be this. She said, it's important to manifest gratitude, both to the world around you and the people whose lives and existences brought you here. But she made it clear to me that changing the gun, remaking it in another form, could be a manifestation of that gratitude in that respect. She also said something very memorable to me, which is, so she said, listen, you know, fire is only destructive in a European cosmology. In many other ones, including the Salish, you know, it's an agent of renewal. It's what remakes, it's what creates rebirth. And so that helped me reframe this idea of, you know, subjecting the gun to this sort of remaking and trial by fire. So Germaine was an incredibly important person in my life because she's given me good advice and a lot of kindness at important points.
And what's the message of her reciprocity argument, if you will?
Well, I think the heart of it, or one of the important aspects of it, would be this. You know, we've come to talk a lot about sustainability in the West. And Germaine said, no, we have to go beyond that, because sustainability just says, like, how much can you take from a place without it failing? I mean, that's one way to look at it. It's not a complete way, but for the purposes of this, I think it works. What she was saying is, you have to look at these relationships as deeply reciprocal, in that you have to think, how may I give to this place? What can I contribute to this place? Rather than, what's a sustainable level of taking resources from it? How can I engage? How can I become part of the system? How can I actively continue the best parts of what's going on out here, both culturally and ecologically? And that right there, that little, I guess, spark of action, that emphasis on action and the future, was what was so important to me. Because prior to that, I'd been feeling a lot of guilt about, see, as a ranch manager, I can look, as somebody who's spent tons of time, too much time, staring at cows, fence, and grass, I can tell you what it looks like when people are slowly marching down the road to desertification or ecological impoverishment. And when I drive the roads of the American West today, I see it almost everywhere. If you can see that clearly, which I can, you feel a lot of guilt, particularly if your family, like my father's family, has been here since the time of the Plymouth Colony. You know, you look at that and you feel a complicity. But that guilt, for me at least, did not help me contribute or exist in that reciprocal state. For me, that has to do with action and ecological restoration and cultural examination and questioning. And those were the things that I think Germaine nudged me toward.
Today, I'm speaking with Bryce Andrews, author of the new book, Holding Fire. The book is a memoir of inheritance, history, and one gun's role in the violence that shaped the American West. On the cultural examination front, I have to say that when I read your book, I feel like I'm reading the book of a steward of the land, land that was there before you, land that will be there after you. Your job is to take care of it. And it reminds me of a little lesson you give the reader about the land you live on. You've already said it. It's in the Flathead Reservation. But there was an 1887 Dawes Act that, were it not for that act, I guess you could say you wouldn't be owning that land.
Well, the Dawes Act is, and the history of land, tribal ownership, it's a really complex, unjust history. The Dawes Act took communally held tribal land and allotted it to individual members of the tribe. So it was something like the Homestead Act, in the sense that you would say, okay, you know, this family gets this parcel of 160 acres. The problem with it is that, one of many problems with it is that as these individual parcels were allotted, you know, they went through, they allotted these pieces, and then they said, okay, the balance of this land is now open for sale, and that the individual allotted parcels could then be sold out of the tribe. So that the tribal community as a whole, as a nation, lost a ton of land, because as soon as it was out of collective trust, individual families, if they had difficult circumstances or if someone just decided to, could sell it out of tribal ownership, creating a giant checkerboard on this and other reservations. So the modern day legacy of that is that much of the most productive agricultural land is out of tribal hands. So our farm in particular had been, you know, it was originally allotted to a family, someone in the Charlot family, actually related to Chief Charlot. And it was sold out of tribal ownership in the early part of the 20th century and passed through five or six different hands before coming to us. And we agonized, thought a lot about whether it was right or wrong to move here. And I talked a lot with friends of mine who are members of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes. And the thing I think that turned the corner was a conversation that I had with a couple of different people. And the substance of it was this. You know, it was members of the CSKT, the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes, saying, listen, what happened in the past is bad, you know, full stop. However, what matters now is what kind of neighbor you will be, which I took to mean if you come here and live on these lands that have gone out of tribal ownership, you know, if you support tribal sovereignty, if you're a good member of the community, if you try to respect and to some degree right the wrongs of the past, then you can be here and be productive rather than destructive. And that's what my wife Jillian and I really want to do here. We want to be good neighbors in the most complicated sense of that word.
Well, it's fair to say that you did that in the most pronounced way you possibly could. You took this gun, you took it to a guy named Jeffrey Funk, who comes to your aid in how to forge this thing into something else. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Jeffrey Funk and then maybe a little bit about the tree spade. There's a really nice photo of the tree spade in your book, pretty impressive tool. And you might tell us what the tree spade has wrought, finally, because of course, that's the whole point behind this.
First, Jeffrey. I mean, Jeffrey Funk is an amazing craftsman. He's a deep thinker who can make almost anything in metal. I remember the first time I went up to Jeffrey's shop. So Jeffrey runs something that's called the New Agrarian School, which is up in Big Fork, Montana. And it's something that everybody should be aware of, because it's one of the few places you can go and learn the traditional techniques of blacksmithing from somebody who is thinking deeply about what those techniques mean in the modern age. So, you know, Jeffrey has this immaculate shop, you know, with all of these amazing power hammers, all the incredible instruments of blacksmithing. And that's the shop that he builds his own artwork and metalwork out of. And it's also where he teaches the courses of the New Agrarian School from. But he opened that shop to me and was kind enough to teach me all of the techniques that were required to turn this complex item in the form of this revolver into a tree spade, which is a tool that is purpose-built for rewilding. It's a really interesting tool. It's got one end of it is sort of a hoe, so it's a wide, sharp blade for clearing sod. And the other end of it is a long, thin shovel, which is for planting seedlings. So it looks a little bit like a pickaxe or a Pulaski, but it's really made for one purpose alone, which is taking grassland and turning it into forest. And that's what I use it for on this farm. So our farm used to be in part timbered, particularly some of these little areas where water seeps out of the forest, which is directly above our place. And you have these really sort of interesting areas that were cleared for pasture and became pretty darn boring during the 20th century. And what I've been using this tool for, the tree spade that we made from the revolver, and I'm glossing over here a process that took us about like 4 months and required an entire education on my part and a lot of patience on Jeffrey's part. But I've been using this tool to reforest a corner of this farm. So to restore some fragment of the native ecology of this farm.
Very impressive indeed. I'm going to take a romantic break here in our show. I don't think I've ever had a chance to do this, but I got a big charge out of a trip I think you were making to a gun shop to or from. And you helped this young woman. And I think you gave her a lift. This young woman is now going to bring you your second child in the Andrews family. Just tell briefly how that happened. That's quite a coincidental tale.
It's a crazy story. and it's part of the story in this book, because meeting Jillian changed the entire trajectory of my life. You know, I was coming home on the interstate highway, Interstate 90 here And it was the first blizzard of the year. It was, you know, dark in the evening. And I came around this blind corner and there was a little hatchback, like a station wagon kind of car that was jackknifed, like sideways to both lanes of traffic. And it was very icy. So, you know, I locked up the steering, skidded, missed this car by inches. And I pulled over to the side of the road and went running out there to see if there was a person in there, if there was something I could do to help. And there was this, you know, wonderful, lovely woman sitting there in shock, but unhurt. And so I jumped in the car and was trying to get it started to get it off the road. And we were at, you know, semis were whipping by. We almost got hit and killed a couple times. And I got the car off the road. And it, you know, it started and could barely drive. It was totaled, but, you know, it could kind of creep along. She'd spun and crashed into the median. And we sat there and we talked for a couple hours while the wrecker came. And then we parted ways without exchanging information at all because, you know, we were both in other relationships at the time and only met again months later by chance outside of Missoula. And Jillian and I, you know, from that point, were pretty much inseparable and have been ever since. That story comes into this book because it's a huge part of my life, but also because without Jillian and I meeting that way, I wouldn't have our daughter, Thea. And, you know, I dedicated this book to Thea because something really interesting that happens probably to everybody when you have a kid. And it's that you stop thinking about yourself as the end of a long line and you start thinking about yourself as being somewhere in the middle. And that shift, oddly, like that was a huge part of what made this book come together in my mind, is realizing that it's not just about, you know, what did your forefathers do? How were they good? How were they bad? What were their effects on the land? And what are you responsible for because of that? But it's looking ahead. And there's something so hopeful about realizing that you're not the end of a line. You're a point somewhere in the middle. So that's why I told that very personal story about meeting Jillian. And that's why this book has so much to do with our children.
Well, the good news for the Andrews family and the good news for our readers is that you're working on another book that's going to be about the Salish Sea, better known as Puget Sound, where you actually get in a boat of sorts and go, what'd you tell me, 400 miles before we went on the air, I think you said. And we're anxious to see that, but it'll also give you and Gillian an opportunity to dedicate the next book to your next child, which is due sometime in the next few months. Am I right about that, Bryce?
Well, quite honestly, since this book has required me to be gone for weeks at a stretch rowing up the coast, I think if anyone deserves to have it dedicated to them, it would be Jillian.
There you go.
For keeping our farm on the rails and carrying my share of the load of parenting for those couple week chunks. Yeah, I'm at work on that. You know, the thing, it's a funny thing because you, as an author, you tell people about the projects you're working on at the time when you're doing the research, the traveling, the physical, the practical work of the book. And then for years afterwards, they go, how's that book coming? And you and you have to say, you know, still coming, working on it. And so, yeah, this project with the building the boat and rowing it north, it will take a lot more work. But hopefully I've done enough travel to have the material that I need, and I can just settle in this winter and work hard on it.
Great, great. Well, we look forward to reading it, and I look forward to having you back here on Reader's Corner. Again, I've been talking to Bryce Andrews. He's the author of Holding Fire, A Reckoning with the American West. Bryce, thanks for writing this incredible take on the American West, and thanks for being with us today at Reader's Corner.
Bob, thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be back here, and I really appreciate the invitation.
Thank you. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is James Baker, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Custer. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.